Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Wall Street had a quiet upside bias. Ross takes a look at the U.S. and Canadian dollars, gold, and crude. Rick Ackerman, editor of Rick's Picks on rickackerman.com, joins us from Florida. He comments on whether the Fed really needs to hike interest rates anymore, and are we about to see a rapid decline into deflation and a real estate crash? Rick also has a special offer for our listeners. Longtime BC brokerage veteran Victor Adair joins us to chat about U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's controversial trip to Taiwan and how the markets reacted to it. He also doesn't think we have enough copper to carry out the electric vehicle revolution. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, recycling trade publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Ross, what kind of week did we have on Wall Street?
This was one of those quieter weeks with an upside bias. Just fitting very, very nicely with the modeling that I've been looking at. We had that big oversold reading back in the middle of June, and the monthly charts gave some very strong signals. You get the type of thing you get once every 2 to 3 years, looking back over decades. And once you're oversold and you're against a rising moving average, like the 50-month moving average, then you can expect to get a really good bounce out of that, and typically it's going to be in the 60 to 70% bracket. So as far as the S&P is concerned right now, it's got a little bit more running room to go here. We're around 413 on the index. If you take a look at the Dow, it's managing to already get up to what would be reasonable targets. And the NASDAQ, same type of thing. Pretty decent week there, nothing wrong. And it's been with, if we take a look at the currency side, U.S. dollar sliding a little bit here, not a lot to worry about there. The index itself around 106 after having topped at 109, and still think that the ultimate support might be a little bit lower than this, maybe another 3 or 4 points as far as that one is concerned. And the other currencies, the Canadian dollar, had a decent end of the week, still looks reasonably heavy. You look at something like the British pound, exhaustion signals here a month ago, good bounce, but maybe running out of steam at this point.
What's happening with gold?
Gold continued early into the week on the upside. The bias here, you know, for me is that we've definitely put in that nice capitulation low back 3 weeks ago, and a good rally out of that bottom. At this point, I think still that this rally is going to take us through the month of August. You're going to get some pauses along the way, but this thing's got reasonable bias in it. A little bit of a pullback would not be a surprise. You know, maybe it gives back a third of the gain off the lows, but that's about all that I would expect at this point. The miners, as I mentioned last week, really underperforming. We are just not seeing anything when you look at the big names, the Agnicos, the Newmonts, they're going nowhere. The GDX is just stuck down here at a low level. And so my, you know, the feeling out of this one is that once the gold rally maybe has run its course into September, we will probably be back down retesting the lows again.
What's the story from the oil patch?
A poor week for oil. And, which will end up being a good week for those who are looking to fill their gas tanks in the near future. Closed the week this week, lowest levels since, back in, January, February. We're at 88.5. And now, you take a look at this and say, is this a top? If so, then, support could be well below this, down into the, back into the 70s. The key on the upside, here is around $92. That had been support that was tested in, March, April, after that run to 130. So you had that first, pullback, some good oversolds there, rallied to 120. Now we've come back down, tested that $92 level, broken it. So the key here is going to be, can the market manage to, get back above 92? I think it's going to be a little bit, difficult to do that. And, you know, if we take a look around then, the implications on that one, well, for the Canadian dollar, that is not good. The same type of thing probably over for the British pound. As far as the other commodities are concerned, the soft commodities, like corn, wheat, and soybeans, that, we've been looking at that rolling top back in March, May. They've dropped pretty significantly. The DBA has gone from 22.5 down to 19.5. And, as, mentioned a few weeks ago, the talk instead of being about, rising inflation, is going to be about declining inflation as far as commodities are concerned. Maybe not for the public because there's the markup at the when you finally get to the till, but the actual commodity prices themselves appear to have had a decent rollover top right now.
Give me some raw grain and I'll make my own flour. Ross, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Nice to be there, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Rick Ackerman, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website RickAckerman.com. Rick, you're speaking to us from South Florida today?
Sunny South Florida, right. Come down and join us. It's like being in one of those internment camp ovens. Yeah, it's weird. We get sort of low to mid-90s every day, and it winds up being hotter in places like Berkeley. It's hard to believe.
Can you tell us just a little bit about Rick's Picks on RickAckerman.com?
Well, Rick's Picks has two things. It's got commentary that's generally way off the beaten path and very contrarian, but not knee-jerk contrarian because we get it right. For instance, being bullish on the dollar when just about no one else was. I'm still bullish on the dollar even though we're still obsessing over inflation. So we have the essays that go out. There's a great chat room that draws traders, some of the best traders from all over the world. We had an amazing trade this morning when the E-mini S&Ps did exactly what a chart I'd sent out last night predicted. And so the chat room is full of real-time ideas, and of course the trading touts themselves are they're out daily, updated 24/7. So that's a lot of freebies there too, how to do butterfly spreads and things like that.
Do you have any special offers for our listeners?
Yeah, you can take if you go to the homepage rickackerman.com, just click on the free trial, and there you'll be.
Are central bankers likely to inflate their way out of their latest problems?
I'm not sure. The way you phrase that question, it maybe implicitly acknowledges that the real problem is now and always has been deflation. And we've had quite a consumer inflation, but it goes up against hugely larger numbers that are there in the form of debt that's accumulated in the financial system. And, you know, I always raise the question, why do we need a $2 trillion derivatives market to service a global economy that's no bigger I get my numbers mixed up because they boggle. But the derivatives market is in the quadrillions, and global GDP is only around 200 trillion. So why do you need this banking edifice that's essentially debt instruments, very highly leveraged debt instruments? Why do you need such a huge market to service a global economy that's only a tenth the size of the financial economy? So that represents a deflationary juggernaut that at some point is going to be actualized.
Could we have inflation in some areas and at the same time deflation in other areas?
Up to a point, but when we get a real deflation, it's going to be the real deal. We'll be in a barter economy, and things can only get so inflated when people are swapping their gold doubloons for loaves of bread or whatever. So no, the coexisting deflation really hasn't. We're on the down slope, and that's where we're headed now. And it has to do with the fact that the expansive idea that's kept the stock market going higher and higher. That's everybody basically thinking it's going to go higher than where I buy it. Well, that's no longer reliably true. So in the big picture, just how people think, the craziness that generates high price earnings multiples, that's gone. So it's going to take a while for deflation to hit, but there are a lot of things waiting to implode that are going to cause it to happen.
The Bank of England's warning that we could, or at least in Britain, see 13% inflation, and perhaps we're being more honest than the governments here when they lowball our inflation rates at around 8 to 10%.
No. The bad news is that no, we're not going to get, I don't think, 13% inflation, because this deflationary juggernaut is so much huger, it's so much more powerful than the consumer inflation we're experiencing. And that's not to say we can't have more consumer inflation. You read about how the skew in prices of fertilizer are going to bear on the prices we pay for food that's harvested in the coming months. So that's inflation that's still in the pipeline, and it could be very considerable in the groceries sector. But the bigger picture really is, to me, it's incipiently deflationary.
What do you see ahead for interest rates?
Well, I don't see interest rates just rising to the moon. I had a target out more than a year ago of 3.56% on the 10-year note. And I never stopped to pause about why and how. It's just a target on a chart. And we hit there. We got very, very close to 3.56. And I think that's it. The Fed tightened one last time, but they don't really have to do any more tightening, as they're going to discover, as everybody will discover, because things are tight enough already to snuff the U.S. and global economy. It's not like you can't think back to the Volcker days when we were dealing with 18-20% inflation, we're in a very different environment. But so much more, the difference being that so much more money has been borrowed for all things, mostly, as I mentioned, the leveraging of financial instruments. But we have such huge level of borrowing that subjecting them to just a 50 basis point increase, it hugely increases the burden of debt for everybody. So we really can't get up to this 18 or 20% inflation, because just the bond price adjustment, the bond yield adjustment on that alone would be more than all of that borrowing could withstand.
Could June 17th have been a significant bottom for the stock markets?
I don't think there's a prayer in hell of that, really. We're in a bear rally. And yeah, I have to say that never say never, and the market, as we've discovered, is capable even of enough craziness to get it to new all-time highs, despite this horrible economic environment we're in. You know, you can split hairs over whether we're in a recession or not, but people look around, and everybody I know is, they're paddling pretty hard upstream, really. A lot of people paddling pretty hard just to stay afloat. So the real economy, where we talk about jobs and consumption, retail and this and that, it's already collapsed. And in certain retail sectors, it's beyond collapse. It's actually gone. So there are a lot of people marginally employed and no longer supported, well, by government payments. So it's, so we don't need any more tightening. We're already there.
The U.S. government claims that over 500,000 jobs were created last month. Can we believe those numbers?
Yeah, it's like talking about the money supply. You know, that these guys don't have a clue about jobs or how many people are sitting on their butts and are never going to work. There's so many variables there, the quality of jobs and the debt that is being serviced by the income from those jobs. So that the job, even if someone actually got the jobless figure correct, what would it mean? You know, nobody could really figure out. It has no usefulness. And, of course, it's even worse because they just kind of invent the number. So my attitude is, who cares? But there's no question the market responds to it. But it responds, I mean, the people doing the buying, jumping on stocks, running the market up and down and crazy like it was today, they're not stupid either. I mean, they see the same things that you and I see, but they have, their jobs are really to be knee-jerk whatevers. And so when the jobless number comes out, they all know it's just a lot of crap like you and I. Like, who cares? Even though the press pretends that it means something and they get all excited about it. But the people who are in the stock market going crazy when the numbers are released, they think like you and I. They know, well, jobless, who cares? Who knows? What does it mean? No one could even tell you that. But the problem for them is that when a jobless figure's hit, they're thinking, well, what are the guys at the trade desk down, you know, two buildings on Wall Street, what are they thinking? And so you have to assume that everybody else assumes that you're going to buy it and they're going to buy it, so they all wind up buying news that's ostensibly without meaning or value. So they're just sort of going according to form because they have to. They have to assume the other guy's going to do it, and all the assumptions create these little mini flurries of buying.
Could the U.S. dollar have topped in July?
No, and I haven't really been talking about a dollar top over the last 30 years because we've been gradually moving toward a deflation that would power the dollar. And you'll notice that nobody's really had much to say, even when the discussion has shifted universally on the TV shows and the press and everywhere else about inflation. Nobody has done much explaining about the strong dollar. You know, the accepted definition of inflation is an increase in the supply of dollars. I don't buy that, or I don't think that's a very useful definition, but it'll serve for this example. So we've been obsessing over inflation, but the dollar has somehow moved higher, and those two things are they shouldn't be able to coexist. But not only have they, the dollar is I think just on a holy tear that's going to kind of wreck the Fed's plans and everybody else's plans, because the last thing in the world that we need, since everybody's borrowed up to their eyeballs, is a strong dollar.
Does real estate look like it could crash? And if so, how bad would the crash be?
Well, I've been saying we'd have a crash of 70%, and much worse than that in the second home sector for forever. And we got halfway there in 2008 and 2009, But it's clear from the inflation in real estate that's occurred since then that nobody learned any lessons. So now you can even bring the demographic argument into the idea that a housing collapse is absolutely inevitable, just by asking the question, well, who's going to buy these baby boomer homes? You know, the baby boomers downsized, the irony being that that the prices are such that you could leave just a beautiful colonial brick home in Westchester County and get a relatively modest condo down in Florida, and you're paying more for the Florida condo. So, all right, so there are all these houses and still some downsizing to do for the baby boomers. But who's going to buy those homes ultimately? Will it be the millennials who are living with their parents till they're 35 and trying to make money with their art history degrees, and having maybe some of their debt, college debt, not forgiven? They won't be able to buy those homes. And so the homes will eventually be conveyed as estates to the children, and they won't be able to pay the taxes on them or maintain them. So that's going to hit the tax base of virtually every little enclave in America, of, $500 to $1 million, $1.5 million homes. And they're more than you can imagine. I mean, there's nowhere you can go. You can go to some deepest, darkest boondocky place in Mississippi, and there'll still be a development there with $800,000 homes. They're all over. So there really aren't any buyers for those homes at the current price. But and also, of course, the prices have gotten so absurd, and mortgage rates have doubled. And so, yeah, the housing market is a dead duck.
The price of crude's been falling since June. Where do you see the price of oil going from here?
Well, we came out of the 2007-08 collapse having learned nothing, but desperate to figure out what could be hocked 10 times over in the new in the new regimen. So the financiers, the paper shufflers, settled on the energy patch. So a lot of the derivatives market, a lot of financial instruments, highly leveraged ones, are linked to the collateral of oil and natural gas. So those prices will keep coming down. There's always, you know, before you get short up the wazoo on natural gas, though, you have to realize that that anything could happen to disturb distribution in a way that would skew prices enormously. So there's always a risk. I think the long-term trend now will be deflationary, with oil kind of feeding the deflation that's going to occur in the financial markets, because we desperately need higher energy prices, but as desperately as we need them, that makes them that much less likely to occur.
Now, some oil analysts I've talked to say prices could really skyrocket this fall and winter because Russia is going to cut off its supplies to Europe, especially Germany, the economic engine of Europe. Will that affect prices here in North America?
Yeah, it certainly would. I mean, the Russians have a very significant impact on energy supplies for Europe, and we've been talking about the dark winter that Europe is going to experience, perhaps, because they're entirely dependent on Russian natural gas. So, but I don't know. The Russians could certainly use the money, and they probably also know that precipitating something horrible like putting Europe in the cold and dark all winter is not anybody's idea of an answer. I mean, it might be China's answer. You can sort of see China strategizing in a way that says, well, we're going to just collapse the whole world, because we know that China is best equipped to emerge from the collapse, the strongest country in the world. But Russia, not so. You know, Russia, as I said, needs the money. So I don't think they're going to do anything as rash as screw Europe on energy.
So your prediction for natural gas this fall and winter?
Well, amazingly, it's always going to go higher. We know that when supplies are plentiful, when we were glutted with natural gas a couple years ago, it didn't cause our monthly gas heating bills to go down. So there's always, it seems like there's a natural upward pressure built into those prices because the whole, you know, the energy markets are rigged. And I don't know whether we have, there's global growth. It uses some energy, but most of the global growth really is, as we've witnessed, is in shuffling paper, and that doesn't require too much energy. It's not like everybody's building big manufacturing plants right now. And even the Chinese are in kind of a wallow.
Is gold likely to remain in a trading range?
Gold is so desperately wanting to break out, and there seems to be consensus with my subscribers that the 1680 low on the COMEX futures contract was just about it. And I'm not so sure myself. You know, gold is having such a tough time getting airborne, but again, considering what it's gone up against in terms of headwinds from a strong dollar, I would say gold is pretty much, it's done a good job holding its own.
Is silver likely to remain in a narrow trading range?
No, it'll go with gold. Gold will pull it along, and sometimes it'll look a little stronger than gold. And in the end, you know, when you've got a rip-roaring bull market in bullion, it's silver that's going to outperform.
Technically, the U.S. is in a recession with two quarters with negative growth. Now, if that's the case, what technically needs to happen to turn a recession into a depression?
Nothing needs to happen. It's going to happen all on its own. And while, you know, the administration is insisting on changing the semantics of recession, but it doesn't matter what you read in the news or whether we call it a recession or not. You can just look around you and see how the economy has been decimated by not only COVID itself, but by what is becoming a tradition from COVID, which is let's not work. Let's have wherever the government support us or whatever, or let's move out to the suburbs where we can live without having to work, sponge off mommy and daddy or whatever. So the work ethic has changed enormously, and we're just not going to get out of it. There's nothing the Fed can do, and all the trends in place are simply going to worsen.
Central banks in the U.S. and Canada look like they'll continue to raise bank rates. How high could interest rates go, and how long could it take to get to that high point?
They will not, and they cannot. There's no reason. You know, the when they got the 10-year got up near that 3.56 target I mentioned earlier, rates were already high enough to snuff the global economy, and that's what's happened. They don't need to raise rates anymore. And I think that they did this last 75 basis hike with the cynical calculation that it had been entirely discounted in the markets. Up till the announcement, there was still some speculation, will they or won't they, or will they do just 50 basis points or no hike at all? But the calculation that was already in the market gave them sort of a free pass to raise the rates by 75 basis points and not suffer some sort of calamity. And not only did the Fed decision to raise rates 75 basis points not cause a calamity, the market screamed. You know, we're sort of on the sputtering out end of that right now. But the 3 weeks ago, a month ago, everybody had so completely discounted they were all ahead of the negatives. Like all the companies were going to report horrible earnings and the Fed was going to tighten. And so it became such a surefire bet to just get short that everybody did. And so your first clue that the Fed was going to get away with tightening and the market would scream instead of collapsing was that when each of the biggies announced, like Microsoft was out with earnings and Google and Amazon, and they all had dismal reports, and yet each stock, it popped after hours, huge. There were huge short squeezes going on in all these stocks, and the Fed enjoyed, psychologically speaking, the benefit of that short squeeze. It was already underway when they tightened, and you could see the fix was in. So everything was rallying into a horrendous environment, but of course it raises the question, okay, what now? because, you know, perversely, you could say, well, it can't get any worse than this, so I think that, or it can't get any, the news, we don't have any more bad news to drive the market higher, so what now? And that certainly doesn't point, the question doesn't suggest higher stock prices are coming.
What are your thoughts on electric vehicles?
They're a hoax. I mean, they work great, and they have great acceleration. They're pretty cool from a technological standpoint. But from the energy standpoint, which is why they're getting the official push, you know, and all the tax incentives and this and that, it's not like that power is just coming out of nowhere. We're generating with coal plants or, you know, natural gas or in very, very limited sense with nuclear. But, you know, the ideal would be all solar power, generating enough electricity to run those cars. But basically, when you plug into your charger overnight, people seem to act as though that energy, that the power comes from nowhere. And, so, you know, when you talk about the other end of it, like, what do you do when it comes time to dispose of all these batteries and this and that? It's not a really economical solution, at least now, given the way we get our power.
Why do liberals dump their oldest friends?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. I had an essay, not written by me. It was a guest essay from one of my best friends. He's a real out of the box thinker. He's a Mensa member, so he's a smart guy. And I said, well, why? You know, I've lost four or five of my oldest friends, and it can't be just political differences. Like, I thought the election was fixed, and you know, they say, well, I got no more, you know, we don't have anything more to talk about. I thought there had to be something deeper at work there than mere political differences. So my friend came up with the theory that it's something that's congenital. It has to do with the size and configuration of our brains, particularly the amygdala, where amygdala is kind of the seat of emotional response in your brain. And so in terms of brain physiology, you're kind of born predisposed to liberal or conservative, in the sense that the liberals, to give them the benefit of the doubt, that their brains are filled with imagined possibilities of the ideal, like all the ways in which we can improve things so that they're ideal. The conservatives are more, you know, let's be careful here, especially making radical changes to bring about this ideal. You know, they're hardwired for more practical thinking. And it really has to do with the brain and how it's wired. And it turns out that the more thinking you do, the more the hard wiring becomes entrenched. So that's just the brain making the things that you do more efficient. So liberals tend to get more liberal and conservatives more conservative, to the extent that each advocates something different for a path forward. And so you wind up with these brain adaptations, and when a liberal is challenged with some conservative idea, or let's say, to be more explicit, let's say the liberal is challenged with the idea that the election was fixed, which it was, their response is not to the political implications of that. It's more to, it's a survival thing. The brain is saying, look, if you don't fight these ideas with everything you've got, you're going to be extinct. Liberals will be extinct. So they're basically just trying to survive, and their amygdalas produce this emotional response that precipitates out as a lost friendship.
Rick, how can people sign up for your free trial offer and subscribe to your products?
Well, if you just go to rickackerman.com and click on the free trial, you'll be there in a jiffy. Just be sure to stop by the chat room and say hello. I did say earlier, I think it's the best chat room in the trading world, because it's a very friendly place, and some great traders are willing to share real-time ideas with anybody who comes in the room. So it's the spirit of helpfulness is very strong in that room. So just be sure when you sign up for your free trial to head for the chat room and enjoy the show.
Rick, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Well, thanks for inviting me on, Jim. I always enjoy the opportunity to connect with your audience.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. He was speaking to us from Florida. Coming up, Victor Adair, next on This Week in Money.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair. Recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in British Columbia, but he's still very active with the markets and on top of a very interesting game. Victor, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be with you.
Victor, if people want to check out your website, how can they find it?
VictorAdair.ca, and I post a blog up there pretty much every week about what I see in markets, lots of charts, lots and lots of charts, actually. So, and everything on the website is free access to anybody that wants to go there.
U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi went to Taiwan this week. Even though the Chinese warned her not to go, they promised retribution. They've been buzzing the island and the neighbors with missiles and Navy ships and so on. However, the markets seem to take it in stride. What are your thoughts on Nancy's little tour of Taiwan / Taipei?
Well, I think ahead of her actually arriving there, there was some question as to whether or not she'd go. You know, there was everybody had an opinion about whether she should or not. The way I trade is I trade on what I think will happen rather than what I think should happen. At least I find that's more profitable to do that. I thought to myself, you know, if she actually goes to Taiwan, given, you know, how aggressive the Chinese have been in warning her not to go, the stock market, which has been on a rally for the last 6 weeks, and I've thought it's a bit of a bear market rally, I thought, you know, the stock market might take a turn lower. So on that and other considerations, I took a short position in the stock market, the S&P futures. And then the night of the event, let's say, you know, she was going to land there in very, very early on West Coast time, I noticed that Flight Tracker had about 750,000 people tracking where her airplane was. And I thought, maybe this is not such a good idea after all. As her plane was approaching landing there, I noticed the stock market wasn't selling off, and I thought that it would have if she was going to land. So I exited my short position. I thought, you know, I don't think this is such a good trade. Yeah, she landed, spent a few hours there, departed. The Chinese did, as you say, buzz the island, fired off some missiles and all that sort of thing, and the stock market seemed to take it in stride. So let's go to the stock market. What I see here is when there is an opportunity for a market to go down, and I saw this as an opportunity, and it doesn't, then you have to think maybe this market's gonna go up, or it's got a better opportunity to go up. And I think the old saying is something like a market that won't go down on bad news is probably gonna rise. So this was a great example of that. Now, I don't think we're out of the woods as far as, let's say, retribution or whatever from China. They may not be done yet. But for the here and now, yeah, you're right. The market took it in stride, and the markets closed sort of on their high for the week. So, yeah, that's the cynical look at world events through the eyes of the stock market.
Canada and the U.S. released their July employment figures on Friday morning. The Canadian information weaker than expected. They thought we'd gain 50,000 jobs. Instead, we lost 30,000. The American news was way more robust than expected. They thought they'd increase their labor force by 250,000. They did more than 500,000 new jobs or positions added. So how did the markets react to this job news?
Well, you're absolutely right about the American data. It was astonishingly strong, and I'm sure there's going to be some guys out there that, you know, love to dig into the details, and they'll find out this and that, why maybe it wasn't all that strong, but really, as far as the market was concerned, on a headline basis anyway, it was a shocker. How the markets took it, the interest rate markets started to move higher. In other words, interest rates rising, bond prices falling. The currency markets, the U.S. dollar went bid. The other currencies were offered, I should say. Gold prices had been up on the day. They fell and were down on the day. It was sort of like that. I think what the attitude was, is that let me say it this way. I've thought that the only thing that was going to get the Federal Reserve to, say, back off from being so hawkish, or being as hawkish as the market expected, would be if employment went in the tank. In other words, if unemployment really soared. Well, this was just the opposite of that. So we've got a situation here where the market's been trying to find a balance between the thoughts that maybe a recession was looming, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the thought that maybe inflation would stay higher for longer, and that might mean that the Fed would be more aggressive than the market was pricing, and if that's the case, that might even accelerate, you know, a recession coming. So there's been a lot of twisty kind of thinking here, but in the short term here, that's how it went. And I should say, you know, the stock market, this was a great example about how the stock market is not monolithic. It's not just one thing. There's different aspects of the stock market. So, for instance, the high-tech sector seems to be what we'd call a long-duration asset, much more sensitive to interest rates. So, in a way, you know, high-tech didn't like the stronger number because pushes the anticipation is interest rates will be higher for longer. However, the real economy, so let's say the Russell 2000 shares, were much stronger than the NASDAQ. So that's how that played out, you know, in a nutshell. The Canadian information was just absolutely lost, I think, while everybody was focused on the American data, came out exactly the same time. But the net result was, you know, the Canadian dollar was down half a cent to a cent, I guess, at one point on the day. Maybe ended the week down about a half a cent, or ended Friday half a cent below where it was on Thursday.
You've been bullish on the U.S. dollar in every one of our interviews since January last year. The U.S. dollar has rallied to 20-year highs. Are you still bullish on the Benjamins?
Well, in a word, yes, although honestly, the longer the U.S. dollar continues to go higher, the more I think, gee whiz, maybe it'll have a correction. But the U.S. dollar did bottom in January of last year. I think we talked about that a few times. I called it an inflection point, you know, when the Capitol building in Washington was occupied and people around the world were shocked at what was happening in Washington. You know, was there going to be an overthrow of the whatever? The dollar began to rally from there, but the rally really accelerated late last year and this year. And the acceleration happened in harmony or at the same time as the expectations for American interest rate policy really surged. Especially the expectation of how much more aggressive the Fed would be than other principal central banks. So you look at Europe, and it seems like they have got more problems than they can keep track of. And you know, we could make a list, but let's just say Europe seems to be struggling with all kinds of problems, not the least of which is, you know, an open shooting war on their eastern flank. The Euro-Swiss spread, which is something I've paid attention to for most of my career. The euro is the weakest now it has ever been against the Swiss franc. And I think that's a great metric for just how, let's say, nervous Europeans are when they can switch their euro into Swiss francs and feel safer. So there's that. You know, I've said on the show so many times that capital will flow to America for safety and for opportunity. And I think, you know, there's two reasons there right now. Certainly safety, America, despite some folks thinking the dollar isn't worth the paper it's printed on and all that sort of thing. When you're talking currencies, you're talking one currency against another, you know. You're not talking currencies against a bar of gold, for instance. Capital will see relative safety in the United States compared to other countries. And then the opportunity. You know, you can put your money in a bank in Germany and get 0% interest, or you can put it in a bank in the U.S. and get, you know, 3% or whatever the number is. So there's that. I see the U.S. dollar, you know, I look at it on the charts a lot. It just keeps looking like maybe this time is going to be a top, but the big picture here is the trend is your friend, and the trend has been to a higher U.S. dollar.
The energy markets have been exceptionally volatile this year. Since Russia invaded Ukraine, European energy costs have soared. Well, here in North America, crude and gasoline prices have been trending lower for the last 2 months. What do you think's happening in these markets? And dare we think about what could happen this winter when the Russians really put the energy squeeze on Europe?
Well, you know, what you just said there is part of what I just meant when I say there's just a list of almost existential problems in Europe. Yeah, what if, you know, they freeze to death in the dark? I mean, you know, how do you put a price on that? You can't. So it's just this kind of an existential problem. And it's not just the gasoline prices, or call it fossil fuel prices. Because a lot of that is used to generate electricity, electricity costs are just through the roof, you know, throughout Europe, that not only continental Europe, but in the UK as well. What it would look like, I suppose, with shortages and with high prices, is the prospects of rationing, you know, stare you right in the face. And if there's rationing, then that was, you know, you'd think would lead to a weaker economy as businesses have to reduce operating. They're burning coal. You know, they're chopping down trees and burning firewood, restarting their nuclear plants, which I think is a great idea. Whereas, in the United States here, we've got gasoline prices, which had gone to an all-time high early June, or down 35% or so from those levels. WTI is down about 25% or so from where it was. That's, let's say, from roughly $120, $125 back in early June to, you know, around $89, $80 now. Yeah, the markets have been extraordinarily volatile. I think part of the volatility has been due to lack of liquidity in the market. There's like a, with the markets moving around, it's like volatility begets volatility, in other words. If I'm looking to trade markets, I just kind of want to know what's my risk. When I look at, say, the day-to-day volatility in the energy markets, I say, wow, I don't think I want to trade those markets. Well, a lot of people that might normally trade them think the same way. So the open interest, the number we measure, the number of positions that are open at the end of a day every day, I think we're at 7-year lows or something. People have backed away. The markets are just too wild and crazy. You know, why trade? Where do we go from here? Well, there's another aspect to the energy market, of course, and that has been, I have this idea, and it's not mine uniquely, but markets are very much driven by narratives. And narratives, determine behavior, and behavior determines prices. So let me give you an example. The copper market. We had copper prices rise, and speculators came flooding into the copper market, and the narrative was, we're going to go electric, and there's not enough copper around to meet the needs. And no matter how hard we look for a new mine, even if we found a new mine, it's going to take 10 years to bring it on stream. There is just no way, Jose, that there is going to be enough supply, so prices have got to rocket higher. You know, pretty simple narrative, okay? In a way, you know, who didn't know that and all that, but, you know, we got to $5 a pound in copper, all-time highs, and then, for some reason, you know, the price started to fall. I think we've seen a somewhat similar thing here in the energy markets, particularly the fossil fuels, I should be more specific, and with good reason. I mean, every good rumor is going to have some plausibility to it. There definitely are shortages, you know, showing up, and prices have been jumping. But the energy sector was the hottest sector toward the end of last year, I guess, and into the beginning of this year, of any of the market sectors, as, call it, the speculators were jumping all over this narrative, this story about there's this incredible shortage of supply, prices have to go up. Well, speculators generally get into the market and get very aggressive on the long side before tops, and vice versa. You know, they're getting out of markets as they're making the lows. Another example on that same thing is in middle of May this year, I featured on my blog a magazine cover from The Economist magazine. And I had at one time a collection of magazine covers from The Economist, just famous for picking turns in the market the wrong way. Anyway, in the middle of May, when wheat prices were at all-time highs, roughly in U.S. dollar terms, $13 a bushel or thereabouts, the cover was to the effect of, you know, the consequences of shortages of wheat, you know. And basically the line was, you know, millions of people are going to die of starvation. Well, since then, the price of wheat has fallen in half. You know, it turns out that maybe not millions of people are going to die from starvation. I'm trying to make the point is that positioning in the markets and flows, particularly speculative flows, can drive prices too far, either up or down. And I think we've seen some of that in the energy markets. I mean, we had a tremendous run. You know, it was in April of last year where, you know, crude oil was briefly negative. You know, we ran up $100 for, you know, and more from there. So that drew in a lot of speculation. A lot of people I know are talking about the oil companies are making money hand over fist. You know, how can their share prices be going down? Well, you know, that's why.
Victor, there's absolutely no incentive for people to drill for oil and gas in North America now, with both the Canadian and U.S. government saying, no, we're not going to help out at all. And the oil companies, I think I've found out this year, the less that you supply, the more money we make. Why should they look for any oil at all? Just enough so they can charge you $4 a liter instead of $2.50 like they did in Vancouver this summer.
I think if the oil companies thought that they had an unlimited future in front of them rather than what they think now, you know, why go out and spend billions of dollars to try to find oil and process it and whatnot when, you know, the governments that we have currently in power are dead set against us? No, we'll just produce now, take advantage of this, and we're doing share buybacks and big dividends, and there you go. I don't think that's the way I see it anyway.
Gold prices made a new all-time high following the Russian invasion, but we're down $400 3 weeks ago. Can we expect higher gold prices in the future?
Oh, at some point in the future, absolutely. Just don't ask me when, right? okay, let's say when the Russians invaded the Ukraine, gold price jumped a good $150, maybe more. That's what we call a geopolitical shock. We've seen that so many times in the gold market. You go back to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, you know, way back in the late 70s, I guess. Anyway, you have these short-term reactions in the gold market to a geopolitical shock. I think the problem for gold prices, particularly, say, in the last year, from summer of last year till now, with the exception of that spike we had in March, has been a firmer U.S. dollar, and maybe even more importantly, has been rising interest rates, particularly real interest rates. The combination of those two things have been kind of toxic for the gold market. You know, I'll trade gold both from the long side and the short side. I had, I guess the thing is with gold right now, you know, it's been not as popular. If I look at the open interest on the COMEX market, if I look at, the offtake in the ETF market, which I think is where maybe people that are inclined to hold the position longer than futures traders are, show up. You know, the gold market just hasn't been attracting capital. Gold shares, I think, have been beaten up here, more than gold. We may have turned the corner here 3 weeks ago. I don't know. But I'm just saying for the last several months, that has been the problem. A strong dollar, rising rates, and particularly rising real interest rates.
The Canadian dollar made a six-year high near 83 cents a year ago. Since then, it's trended down. It's about 77 cents U.S. Do you think this is odd, given that the loonie often moves in sync with commodities, and commodities have been on a bull trend over the past 2 years?
It is odd, somewhat, but let's go back to school on this. There's, as I've discussed a few times on the show over the past 2 years, the Canadian dollar is primarily driven by the strength or weakness of the U.S. dollar, the price of the up or down in commodities, and interest rate differentials are certainly a function there, and what I would call risk sentiment. So on a short-term basis, day-to-day, if the what I call the bellwether for risk sentiment, that's the S&P 500 futures, are trading. If they're rising, then the Canadian dollar is probably rising and vice versa. Now, the Canadian dollar actually has done well against commodities, except the U.S. dollar is how we price commodities. Let me explain it this way. We've got the Canadian dollar, which is, as you note, weaker by about 6 cents from last year's high against the U.S. dollar, but it's now at a 9 or a 10 year high against the euro currency, against the British pound, and I think it's at a 20-some-year high against the Japanese yen. So the Canadian dollar has been doing really well against all of the currencies in the world, or most all of them, you know, except the U.S. dollar here over the last year. So that's the strength of the U.S. dollar has just been so pervasive, and so it's been so strong that, you know, even the Canadian dollar, which is doing great against other currencies, looks weak.
Yes, I was just saying that compared to the U.S. dollar, the Canuck buck looks bad, but I take a look at the British pound. It was $1.72 for the longest time, Canadian. It's down to $1.54. We haven't had a 20-cent drop like the U.K.
That's right.
Yeah. You take a macro view of the markets, that is, you look at interest rates, currencies, commodities, equity markets, intermarket relationships, kind of a big melange, a mishmash of all that stuff. But what's the most important thing impacting those markets?
The thing that comes to mind, honestly, is Fed policy. And we saw that in spades Friday morning this week when the employment report came out, and that's the American report came out, and it was so strong. The immediate thinking is, okay, what's the Fed going to do? Well, the Fed is going to be just on balance more hawkish than they would have been, you know, before this number was released. And if the Fed is more hawkish, then, you know, the bond prices are going to be falling. Interest rates are going to be rising. The U.S. dollar, you know, this is all of the things being equal. The U.S. dollar is going to be stronger. Commodities priced in U.S. dollars are going to be weaker. And the stock market is probably going to be down because the stock market doesn't like the idea of higher interest rates, which, you know, the Fed's going to keep interest rates higher or make them even higher than before. So it impacts everything. Now, you know, with the points I've been making here, I should say I've got some biases. And as a trader, you know, I mean, I read all kinds of research. I make a point of reading research written by people that I don't agree with them, but, you know, there's some really smart people out there who have different opinions. So one of my fundamental biases is that inflation is going to stay higher for longer than what the market has been pricing. And, you know, what happened today with the Fed kind of feeds into that. Some of the other biases I have, I guess, you know, we just discussed, you know, the U.S. dollar, because of the perceived difference in policy between the Fed and other central banks, the U.S. dollar, I've got a bias, U.S. dollar is going to go higher. Commodities, the same sort of thing. We've had this rush of speculative capital into the commodity market that was been red hot, you know, for the past 2 years, and probably took prices too high too quickly. And now there's some correcting to that, and a lot of that's been driven by the expectation of Fed policy. So, you know, as I said earlier, markets move on flows and positioning. And since the Fed meeting in middle of June, when at the time the Fed raised rates by 0.75 points and promised a lot more of higher interest rates to come, since then the market's been saying, "Nah, we don't think so. We think you're gonna fade. You're gonna back off because raising interest rates into a recession, blah blah blah." Well, today that thinking got a poke in the eye. The Fed has said that they are their rationale or their support or their desire to their need to raise interest rates is unconditional. Well, if they were determined to raise rates yesterday, they're even more determined to raise rates today. And the difference of interest rates against other currencies, against the stock market, against other assets is critical. So Fed policy, I think, is probably in the markets the way they are today, the most important thing. Now, if China invaded Taiwan over the weekend, you know, let's just hope that does not happen. But if they did, then Fed policy is going to be in second place. That's how the market works.
Victor, I know this wasn't something we planned to talk about today. I hope it's okay. Leonardo DiCaprio, nobody speaks out more about carbon footprints and how bad the Alberta oil sands are. Yet this is a man who goes around the world in a super yacht, not known to be the most fuel efficient way to move yourself around the planet, followed by another super yacht full of models. How can anybody believe what a person like that him, you know, says about Canadian energy when he's a huge user of bunker C oil?
Well, I see the president of Brazil, of all places, took the boots, to use my terminology from years ago, to Mr. DiCaprio, pointing out that his yacht burns 300 gallons of diesel an hour or something while it's out there. Listen, there's virtue signaling from different people. It may be heartfelt, and they may be hypocritical in their behavior relative to what they say, and that's, you know, that's how the world is.
I guess supermodels are just not impressed by wind-driven catamarans.
I don't know. I don't know any.
Yeah. Well, I do know how to sail, and it's a lot more ecologically correct, I would think.
Yep.
But, of course, then you can't get to your deadlines for the latest movie to make fun of the Canadian oil industry. Victor, you post weekly trading desk notes on your website, victoradair.ca. I noticed you write a lot about risk management. Do you think that's because the markets are real risky these days?
Yes, they are. You know, I was mentioning earlier about the lack of liquidity in the market, and volatility creates volatility. So, specifically, if I'm looking at a market, I'm trying to say, you know, what am I going to do if I'm wrong? You know, I mentioned moments ago, I've got biases on different markets, and I am very used to being wrong, you know. And I think if you talk to anybody that's traded for a long time and is still here, they would probably say much the same thing. I think you need to have some courage of your convictions to stay with the trade, or you know, you have to do your analysis and your rationale. And sometimes, you know, like with the stock market, for instance, right lately, I've been thinking that we've been on a bear market rally from the lows in June, and I've been wrong. Now, the good news for me is I've taken positions, and I've lost little bits of money here and there, and that's it. And I just, so I'll position myself so if I'm right, I'm going to make a lot of money relative to what I think I would lose if I'm wrong. That's kind of like how I like to position myself in the markets. So we get these big, violent moves, and then it comes to sizing. And I think maybe sizing and keeping the time frame of your analysis and your trading in sync are two of the most important aspects of managing risk, and that's just trading risk. But sizing, time and time again, I mean, I'll see guys that have been around for a long time and have done really well, and one of the expressions I saw recently, somebody had posted on Twitter, something to the effect of, if you're not bored, then you're trading too big. You know, so you shouldn't be trading for excitement, because go to Las Vegas if you want to do that, and, you know, make sure you don't lose any more money than what you said you were going to do. In my line of work here, I'm not doing this for excitement. I'm doing it because that's what I've done for years, and I find it incredibly interesting, and I can also make money doing it. But I'm always, let's say this. For the first several months of this year, I did pretty good. You know, I wasn't hitting it out of the park, but I was going along okay. And for the last 3 weeks or so, I just can't seem to get anything right. Now, that happens. You go through these phases. So, you know, you want to be able to clear your head, you know, not blow up your account while that's happening. And let's say maybe the thing that you want to do is to stay alive so you can trade another day. I think it's just, you know, you don't want to get stubborn about stuff. And markets can move for reasons that you've got no idea why. So you might think that blah, blah, blah is, you know, the market is going to go up because of whatever reason. And it goes up for a reason that is nothing to do with what you thought. So, you know, in a way, you got lucky on that. You just don't know what's going to happen is what I'm saying. And the name of the game is to make money, not to be right. The name of the game is to live to play another day.
Victor, something else, too, that I've just been thinking about is I keep seeing stories on the national news. I invested all my money in Bitcoin. Now I've lost everything. Would you ever put all your money into one thing, especially something that people don't really know a lot about?
Well, no. No. I mean, I wouldn't. I have never traded Bitcoin. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I just didn't. There's lots and lots of things I've never traded, you know. No. I mean, I try to restrict the trading that I do. And let me even be more specific. I have short-term trading accounts where I trade futures markets largely, almost entirely, the big American futures markets where, you know, I know the rules, I know the law, and on and on and on for, in terms of managing risk. I am not trading on some exchange in some country that you couldn't find on a map. I just have no interest in doing that. I want to try to trade things where I think if I'm wrong, I can get out of the trade. Maybe I'll lose a finger, but I'm not going to, you know, lose an arm. I just don't want to trade stuff where I don't know what my risk is, and I had no idea what my risk was to be involved in crypto. I've seen the same stories, you know. It happens all the time. People get told such and such is going to go to the moon for some reason. They believe the story, and it doesn't. You know.
I always wondered if cryptos, NFTs, this meta universe of fake real estate where people have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in imaginary real estate on imaginary islands. This is very much like the tulips back in the 1600s.
Something like that. I know that over time, you know, people have made poor investments. There's an old expression about easy come, easy go, you know. If you work real hard for your money, you're more likely to think twice about how you spend it. And if maybe you made some easy money, you may piss it away without thinking about it.
Victor, is the secret to wealth not making money in good times, but keeping it in bad?
Yeah, that sounds good. I mean, that's what my risk management is all about, is just saying you want to be able to live to play another day. No one trade that I make is important. It's just another trade. I don't even remember, you know, what I did last week, let alone 10 years ago. It's just a process.
Victor, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, it's always fun to talk with you. Thank you for having me on.
My guest has been Victor Adair. Check out his website, victoradair.ca. He was speaking to us from Vancouver Island. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Rick Ackerman, and Victor Adair. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.